Thank you so much. Thank you, Christy. I just want to start very quickly. Is this okay? Can everybody hear me? I want to just thank Christy and Tom and Jay and Megan and everybody at SCJ who made this conference so amazing for all of us. Thank you so much for all of your work, and thank you for having us here. Then I gotta stand up because I'm so excited about this panel, because these writers are some of the most amazing, visionary, gorgeously, just stunning writers of our time and in our country, and I'm so thrilled that they are here with us today. I've been told not to waste very much time reading long bios, but to sort of jump in, but I do want to say that right now we've got romance and heist and dystopian climate fiction with young people with wings and a Steinbeckian family drama. It's just so, I can't wait for you all to hear from them. And I'll start with my first question, which is, we have an audience here of journalists and writers who make their life through words. Can you help all of us understand what we have to learn from fiction writing, from the process and practice of writing fiction, and from the fiction stories themselves? What do we have to learn? And Aya, I'm hoping that you can start us off and maybe share a little bit about fighting transphobes along your journey.
Absolutely. So my name is Aya De Leon. My pronouns are she, her, ella, and it is just such a delight to be here today. I'm so grateful to have been invited and really appreciative of everyone organizing this panel and the conference and just doing the work, right? And the thing that I'll say that I think is really important in terms of fiction writers, you know, I think about Adrienne Marie Brown and Walida Imarisha's work in Octavia's Brood, where they talked about political activists and organizers ultimately being like participating in speculative fiction, that basically we want to create a different future, and that it's about imagining a different future being possible, something that's drastically different from today. And for me, I think the critical thing about fiction is about being able to imagine in this moment, for us to be able to imagine winning in our fight against climate chaos. And I am so grateful for, I think about Octavia Butler's Parable of the Sower a lot, which is, it's its 30th anniversary this year. And I'm so grateful for all the authors who have been, you know, sounding the alarm and writing the cautionary tales and talking about dystopia and where we might end up. They shouldn't stop writing those books. And I think we also need an additional story. Because part of the challenge with dystopia is they all presuppose that we fail in this current political moment. And so we need to also have stories that are about how we win in this current political moment. And that's where I think fiction is really important, because if we look around, we're seeing a lot of really, really hard stories and bad news. But I think underneath all of it is a sort of a rumor that we've already lost. And, you know, some of my mentors have really been pushing me and pushing my community to look at the impact on all of us of trauma, right? And what are the experiences, what are the experiences of trauma that we had as young people that led us to feel defeated? And what is getting triggered or activated for so many of us now in the climate crisis? We have this big crisis and we all feel small. And how is that reminding us of things of things in our early lives where we felt defeated and we felt that we couldn't win? And so that's sort of what I'm obsessed with these days, is how to tell the story of winning, how to widely distribute the story of winning. And last year I founded Fighting Chance Books as a climate justice fiction publishing imprint to publish books about that are all set in the here and now, about communities of people taking collective action to address the climate crisis at scale. You know, I can say a little bit more about that later, but I think part of what we can do as fiction writers is illuminate different things. You know, in speculative fiction, we can illuminate fantasy and myth and possibility in the future. In historical fiction, we can illuminate the past. And I'm sort of obsessed with illuminating kind of movement building possibilities in the present that could bring us to the win.
Hello, I'm Al Heathcock, and I'm originally from Chicago, but I've lived here in Boise for 24 years, which means only 26 more years until I'm a local. And it's really cool that we have this conference here in Boise. We get to show off our city, which we're very proud of, which we wish we had a little bit better weather for y'all. But I talked to the mayor, and it didn't pass, so this is all we have. Being a fiction writer and having mentored, being a professor of creative writing in various programs over the year, I have noticed that when I get journalists who come into the classroom and are looking to write fiction, that more so than any other group, even the engineers or whatever, they struggle. And the ones who I think slide into it most easily are those who have a theater background. I think the fundamental difference is that fiction writing is an empathetic art, that you are doing your best to create an experience that a reader can become someone who is not them, and to have that experience, a lived experience, created for them that's not real. It's interesting that when we're talking about issues, especially with climate issues, but in any environmental issues, that too often when it's written about, it's very factual and statistics and numbers and projections. And a lot of times what's missing out of that is the experience, the human experience that's going to be entering these. And I've always thought that we'd have a little bit easier time to get people really motivated in making changes and asking for bigger changes that we need if that experience was provided. It was about, 2018, there was a major drought in California, and this editor actually called me and said, we want to send down a fiction writer to write about the drought in California. So that you can really capture the experience of being in it. Like, everyone knows it's hot and dry, but what's the experience of living inside that? So I went down to the Central Valley of California, hung out with farmers down there, and wrote about the experience of it. I think about that a lot. One, in writing fiction, that I'm able to create an experience that I can also imbue with all of the stuff that concerns me and the questions that I'm trying to answer for myself, but do it in an empathetic, dramatic art to provide an experience that hopefully is going to be interesting but also provocative and will provoke people into the conversations that I think they should be having. So I think that I'll start that, and I have a lot more to say, but we'll end it on that.
Hi, my name is Ash Davidson. I'm a fiction writer, and I live in Flagstaff, Arizona, about 75 miles from the Grand Canyon in northern Arizona. And I think that fiction has the ability to sort of fill in the gaps of history, especially when you think about who, and sometimes gaps that journalism can't get at either. And I think that speaks to like who's telling the story and whose stories haven't been told. And I also think that fiction can be a really good vehicle for talking about heavy material in a way that doesn't lead to hopelessness or weigh a reader down in the same way. And a little bit can go a long way in fiction. I think you need about 3 details to convince people of most things. And I think in an era where a lot of people have just sort of shut down and stopped reading the news or listening to the radio, it's a way to reach an audience of people who might not pick up nonfiction or journalism about a subject, but if you offer them a way in through fiction, they might come along with you in a way that it's harder to do in your journalism.
Thank you so much, everybody. I'm wondering if you can all speak now to how the environment or how the climate shows up in your work, and how you navigate that in the fiction landscape.
Counting on having the minutes to think. So the book I wrote, Damnation Spring, is a very personal book, even though on the surface I don't have a lot in common with my characters. It's a novel about a very tall logger in his 50s named Rich Henderson, who's obsessed with this one very tall old growth redwood tree called the 24/7 tree. It's a tree he believes he was born to harvest. And it's also a novel about his wife, Colleen, who's a midwife, who starts to suspect that herbicides the logging industry is using might be poisoning their community. And they rely on a creek for drinking water. And my family lived in Plymouth, California, in almost exactly the same spot where Rich and Colleen live in the book. And like Rich and Colleen, we relied on a creek for drinking water. And my parents became so concerned about herbicide runoff in that creek that they stopped drinking from it, although they still use the water to wash our dishes and our clothes and to bathe. And we left Plymouth when I was 3. But Plymouth didn't leave us. You know, that habit came with us. Almost 40 years later, no one in my family drinks from the tap. And I was really curious about that. And I mean, if you think about fiction as a vehicle for talking about the environment and environmental issues, I think in my case, at least in this book, it wasn't a car or a truck or even a spaceship, it was a time machine. Like, this was my way of getting back to Plymouth in the 1970s and wandering around in the world of my parents' stories. You know, the redwoods were the most beautiful place they'd ever lived. It was populated by these funny, tragic, dramatic characters, and I just so desperately wanted to get back there. And very quickly in my research, I learned that the herbicides being sprayed behind my family's home were a mix of 2,4-D and 2,4-5-T, which you might recognize as the active ingredients in Agent Orange. And so I set out to write a book about herbicide contamination, not thinking about climate, not thinking about the environment, a very personal sort of family-based story. And I think that, so I might not be the best person to answer the question about environment and fiction, because I started more with a family, sort of a series of family anecdotes that expanded out. But I think that you can't really write about people and the world without writing about the environment around them. So I would argue that no matter what book you're working on, especially in the time that we live, it's an environmental book. You just, if you don't think it is yet, you just haven't found that through line, but it's there.
I've had an interesting time with this book. It came out in August, and I've been traveling a lot.
Did you know that Sue Boise is a leader in wildlife conservation? Thanks in part to our visitors and the generosity of our sponsors, we would like to take this opportunity to thank our season sponsors, Idaho Ford Stores, U.S. Bank, Perkins Coie, Intermountain Eye Center, the J.R. Simplot Company Foundation, Albertsons, Orkin, KTVB, Paddles of Poke, and Coca-Cola. Thank you, and remember that you help keep your world wild by visiting Zoo Boise.
Thank you. So it's been interesting traveling with the book. When I started writing the book, I started writing it because, probably like a lot of people, I was very concerned about where we are heading on multiple fronts. When writing the book, I never thought of it as dystopian. I definitely didn't think of it as science fiction. I thought of it as realism, but just in the future. And I was surprised when my publisher said, you know, where are we going to put this? And we're going to call it science fiction. And I feel completely uncomfortable with that at all. I'm not a science fiction author. I feel weird about it being called science fiction because it feels then it's some other imagining or something like that. And it's also awkward traveling with this book because it's kind of projecting on the trajectories that we see, that if those trajectories are not interrupted somehow, that the future that, you know, we'll see and that my daughter will live even more so in, is not going to be that great on multiple fronts. And it's also kind of I have found with this book that I just traveled to Maine and I went around to a lot of college campuses, very smart students, and that Gen Z really understands the book more so than older people, because they don't think of it in terms of science fiction or like this is some fun dystopian thing. We're going to watch like the Hunger Games and oh, look how crazy the story is. Like the conversations that I had with these college students at Bate College, Bowdoin College, these very smart students, were all about the truths of the world that we're already in and that maybe they are recognizing with more potency than maybe some of the older generations, the present company excluded from that, were really invested and interested in having these conversations about how the environment in all of the different ways, whether it be climate change and how it's affecting just weather and storms getting larger and more frequent, to food supply issues and agriculture, all the different small cultural ways that the climate is going to affect us. So, well, for me, it was me just very concerned with the world and trying to find a container to put all my questions, and not all of them are answerable, but I threw some speculation in the mix of what trajectories there are and what might happen if they aren't interrupted. So it's a weird thing saying, I hope nothing in this book comes true. And it's also weird that with the stuff in the book, I keep getting like emails from people who've read it or from my publicist back in New York. We just had major flooding in California and that's in my book. And so like my publicist sent me like the articles, ow, look what's happening. And I'm like, what am I supposed to do with that? Like, that's like, share that on social media. Hey, look, I was right that tragedy is befalling us. And so it's a weird book to kind of talk about. I'm very proud of it, and I hope that none of it becomes reality at all.
Thank you. Yeah, I think for me, I have been a social justice writer from the beginning. And my racial and ethnic background is that I'm African American, West Indian, and Puerto Rican. So when Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico in 2017, it was like that climate issue that had been important to me in theory but wasn't really showing up in my work. That was the breaking point for me where I had to make a shift and wanted to put climate in the center of all my work. So I write genre fiction and was writing for a genre publisher who had me on a two-book kind of getting contract that kept getting renewed, and I was doing a book a year. So I had the second book in a two-book contract that was could have been anything, and I was working on one thing, and then Hurricane Maria hit, and I asked my editor, could I change topics because I wanted to write about the hurricane. And you know, I was writing a feminist heist series with sex workers in New York City, and it was like, how am I gonna write about the hurricane? But I figured it out, you know. And I really had to look, because the way the series worked, you would sort of pluck a previous character that had been developed and then give them their own book. And so I was like, I was asking myself, who am I sending into this hurricane? And there was a sort of a character who had, you know, I had sort of fixed her life and everything was solved and she had had a situation work out. And I was like, I'm going to have to figure out how to unsolve her life and get her into a lot of trouble. And I did. And, you know, and it's a heist series. So then I was like, what are they going to steal? You know, and but I had to figure those things out because I was so determined to write about the hurricane and also to write about Hurricane Maria as being this like brutal and tragic intersection of the climate crisis and colonization of Puerto Rico. And that became my book Side Chick Nation, which you know, was the fourth book in this heist, this feminist heist series called Justice Hustlers. So that came out in 2019. It was the first novel to come out about Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico. And then from there, you know, I had these other books that I was working on and just decided to make every book a climate book. So the next book I had coming out was about a black woman FBI agent who was sent to infiltrate a racial justice organization. So I made it a racial justice and environmental and climate justice organization. And so, of course, she's infiltrating it, but in that process, you know, begins to think that perhaps she's on the wrong side. And then the next book that I had was about a sort of a young hip-hop artist, sort of a Megan Thee Stallion type, who is on a cross-country tour of the U.S., and she's falling in love with her DJ, and it's all very messy. And I was like, okay, I'm gonna make that into a climate book. And here's the thing, it's like you said, it's not hard. Like, if you're on a bus going all around the United States, what are you gonna be running into everywhere? The climate crisis, people recovering from incidents in the climate crisis, people being worried about what's gonna happen. And so, you know, and these books are all like, they're sexy romances, they're heists, they're thrillers, or they're like soap opera dramas. And for me, that is part of what's exciting, because I know and trust that journalists are writing about the climate crisis, and I know and trust that folks in the sci-fi fantasy world are writing about the climate crisis, and there's literary fiction about the climate crisis, but like, where are the trashy romances about the climate crisis? Well, I'm writing them. And, you know, and that's what led to me wanting to start Fighting Chance Books. Like, the crisis is so big. Like, I wanted, like, my vision is that for any genre that people love, that I could be publishing a book that they want to read that, like, you know, fulfills all of their desires of that genre, whether it's like, you know, crime fiction, romance, women's fiction, urban fiction. I, you know, like, who, someone needs to pitch me the story about like the urban fiction where like the gang member gets politicized about climate and gets like all the, you know, people in the gang to somehow be part of organizing for climate justice. Please, somebody pitch me that book. You know, like, whatever it is that you want, there's a book about climate that could be happening, because this is the fight, you know? Like, for all the folks who teach creative writing, like, there must be conflict. Dude, there's conflict, right? Like, there's conflict, there are stakes, it's all there. And so, you know, that's what I'm excited about. I have a YA book, you know, that's like a teen spy girl book. And, you know, I'm like, okay, we'll get climate in there. So that's just sort of been my obsession. Whatever, you know, all the little projects I had started, you know, how can they be about climate? The book that I'm working on now is at the intersection of reproductive justice and climate justice. It's about an artist who gets pregnant and has to decide, what's she gonna do as her career is taking off? And, you know, figuring out how to make that about climate as well. I think there's an article that recently came out in the BBC talking about climate fiction, I think this past week, And, you know, the author was saying, basically, anyone who's writing a novel in which the climate is kind of a calm and stable force that everyone can rely on, those are the people who are writing fantasy.
The character is not, the main character is not me. Very different from me in obvious ways. It's a young woman who also has wings, and I have none of those. I wish I had wings. But other than that, though, she's still 100% me in that she is an avatar for my concerns. Moving through this world, which, at least the way I'm writing, is not so much about trying to push plot points for dramatic intrigue, though that's there too. It's more pushing my imagination into places so that it forces me to confront these questions I have. Writing is a way that I process the world. It's always been the way that I answer questions and posing questions that need to be answered. And so there's lots of different questions in the book, but I mean, in terms of environmental concerns, it's, again, we see this trajectory that we're already on. And what does that mean for our future in very realistic ways? In looking at how this comes from conceptual conversations about climate and drops down into human lives, from everything to how it intersects with religious communities, non-religious communities, the military. I think food supply is a huge thing that's going to be impacted, and probably if I have one thing that I read about and think about the most, it's going to be how climate is going to affect food supply. It's not going to affect people in Boise that much, but I grew up in the south side of Chicago, and it's going to affect the south side of Chicago a lot. And so just those concerns bring up questions, and those questions are things that I have to push my imagination into these places and try to look as unflinchingly and as honest as I can be, looking for points of hope within stuff that looks bleak and seeing what I can find, even if there's suffering involved, if there's some provocation of wisdom that I can extract out of that can become a part of a conversation that I'm having with myself that I think people should be having with themselves and maybe with each other even better. But everything that I write is me. Every character is me. Every instance is me embodying these characters and pushing my questions through them so that I can find my way into some sense. What it's going to be.
That's such a great question. I'm sort of obsessed, like the through line in all of my work is about women of color, particularly women of African heritage, and political awakening. You know, like that's the story I keep telling over and over. Like, girl going about her business, girl gets slammed by climate crisis, girl decides to fight. Like that's the formula. And I think partly I'm obsessed with it because it's not me. Like I came from a lefty family. My mom was an elected official. I was walking precincts. I was going to rallies. I was, you know, an activist in my teens in the anti-nuclear movement. I was organizing other teens to get arrested at the Lawrence Livermore Lab in the Bay Area in the early 80s. So I think I'm really fascinated with how do people come to have a particular kind of analysis of the world when they've been offered a different analysis, right? Like my, you know, one of the most challenging characters for me was the FBI agent, right? Because there was no way I was gonna end up infiltrating a black organization. I was gonna be in the black organization. And so that's fascinating to me. And that's sort of my obsession, in part because that's what I think needs to happen, right, in the world, is that people who are currently thinking it's not for me to try and change all these things need to decide, yes, it is for me, and not for me alone. It's for me to be part of a movement that fights for these things. And, you know, each character has some critical piece of me emotionally so that I can connect to them and write them. You know, and really, I think, if, you know, eventually when I have like a big stack of books, I'll be able to go through and say, oh, that character has this about me, that character has that about me, and there will be some important part of me that's in all of them. But that's kind of how my obsession works and how it's shaking down.
So I'm not in this book, nor is anyone taken from life. It's all invented whole cloth. But I do use kind of some unsavory methods to do that. You know, like I'm a terrible thief and an eavesdropper. And I think I could have written this book without the work of journalists, but it would have been a lesser book, less nuanced, less complex. And I'm really grateful to the work of local journalists in particular, and also to journalists who report on the ground and then sort of zoom up a level and look at the political and economic and social questions around something. And many of the best books I read about the Redwoods and the logging industry were written by journalists who worked, you know, covered these issues for years. And as things were being sort of cut and left on the cutting room floor, we're going around with a push broom, collecting them, and then putting them together in a book. And I think that I, like Al, like, I think I come from a question of curiosity, like from a point of view of curiosity. There's something that I want to know. And like Aya, you know, Marilyn Robinson talks about the stories you're drawn to being the landscape of your preoccupations. And I think for me, it's a landscape of obsession, like something I have to know the answer to. And a lot of times those questions aren't answerable. And so in fiction, you can explore them and make them up. And I think that, you know, I came to this book thinking that, if you'll forgive the terrible pun, that it would be pretty clear cut. You know, like there would be loggers on one side and environmentalists on the other. And when I actually started doing my research and sitting down and talking to people who worked in the mills and worked in the woods, I realized that loggers love the woods. You know, they hunt, they fish, they take their kids camping, they pick berries. And they spend their whole lives in the woods. They're often the first sprayed because they're out working in the woods when the helicopter, the plane, comes over with the aerial herbicides. And that really sort of forced me to re-examine my own assumptions going in. And I think I knew that on some level. Like I knew if I wanted to write a book about why herbicide spraying was a bad idea and how it was affecting people, that I needed to come at it from the point of view of someone who disagreed with me, of someone who not only did that work, but thought that it was the right thing to do. And I think that, like, writing the book, you know, I definitely came from a place of anger, I think. Like, there's, the anger in the book is mine, you know, of this, this book took me 10 years to write, and it was year 4 that the brain tumors started in my own family. And so I came from a place of profound personal anger and wanting to change people's minds and wanting people to know about this issue and to care about it and to think about it the way I thought about it. And I think that, like, no one tells you when you set out to write a book to change people's minds to be very careful, because the mind you end up changing might be your own. And that's certainly what happened to me.
Thank you, everybody. I'm actually going to and like back to you, Ash, and ask if you could all please read an excerpt from your pieces so we can hear some of the things that you've been talking about.
Did I ask someone else to start? Because I forgot we were supposed to do this, and I borrowed a copy of my own book and I need to choose a section.
Okay. So I'm going to read from my latest book, That Dangerous Energy, and it's about a woman who is in a love triangle with a climate organizer and a fossil fuel mogul. And You know, and she, Morgan, the protagonist, is raised poor, working class, and so I'm really playing with the billionaire trope in romance. And, you know, Morgan, with her internalized classism, has the sense that rich people are morally superior. So she never really questions when she gets this billionaire boyfriend that, of course, she's lucky to have been chosen by him and wants to marry him. She, at the beginning of the book, she connects with this organizer and there's a spark there, but she decides, like, no. I'm gonna stay on track with my billionaire boyfriend, and the organizer gives her his number, but she, you know, crumples it up and throws it away. But unfortunately, she has a photographic memory, so she can't forget the number. She also unexpectedly witnesses the boyfriend doing something incredibly shady, illegal, and shocking around climate, and can't forget that either. So this is the scene that takes place after she's sort of witnessed this thing and is deciding what she's gonna do about it. It wasn't easy to find a phone booth in New York City these days. Morgan went to Grand Central Station. Not only did she want the untraceable... Not only did she want the untraceability of a phone booth, she wanted the anonymity of a bustling area. In the wide space with commuters rushing by, she felt strangely private. She closed her eyes, dropped in the coins, and visualized the phone number from the airline napkin. Even though she was certain of the numbers, she dialed slowly. Her heart beat hard as she listened to it ring. "You've reached Kevin," his voicemail said, and gave the date. "If you're calling about today's Black Friday action, we'll be outside Amazon's Midtown headquarters from noon to five. Join us." He gave the address and cross street. Then the recorded voice came on, telling her how to leave a message. As if she didn't know, she hung up. Amazon's headquarters weren't far. She could get there on foot. Her legs began walking before she had even made a decision to go. She wouldn't need to actually decide anything yet. She could just go and check it out, see what the protests looked like. Maybe he'd be chained to the building, maybe getting arrested or something, unavailable. She could tell her friend Deshauna she had tried. She walked the 15 blocks to where he was, the chilly wind whipping her hair in and out of her face. She expected loud chants, people blocking traffic. But instead, there was a sweet, mournful sound, a group of street musicians playing nearby, a sort of melodic, harmonic a cappella vocal. As she got closer, the sound got louder, and she saw it was the protest making the sound, a humming, an intense, melancholic tune. When she rounded the corner, there were about 75 people, all in black, humming. They were pressed back against the building on either side of the entrance, not blocking the sidewalk, just standing there. She crossed the street so she could look at them without being noticed. In the center of the group, to the left of the doors, was a coffin. She expected to find a picture of the earth, but instead there were several white chalk outlines of different animals and insects. "Extinct," the sign said. It took a moment to pick Kevin out from the crowd. There were several women on stilts who dwarfed him. But there he stood, humming, eyes closed. He wore a t-shirt that demanded climate reparations for the Pacific Islands. There were no words, no exact melody to their music, just melancholy minor harmonies. The sound suddenly took hold of her and she started crying. She had to put a hand on her own chest to press on a sharp pain. She didn't sob, she just stood there transfixed, crying for something she hadn't even realized had been lost. And just beside the coffin was a man she hadn't realized how much she had missed. The group, on some subtle signal she hadn't seen, slowly brought their final note to a close. The subsequent street noise was strange, abrupt,
the spell broken, the group opened their eyes. Across four lanes of cars and taxicabs, Kevin's eyes widened in surprise at her. Morgan blinked and wiped her face. It was now or never. She ran across the street, weaving between the stopped traffic. Kevin's brow was knit. She felt offensive in her brightly colored dress among the mourners, but she had to talk to him. "We are here today," a woman began in a megaphone, "to mourn what has been lost and talk about what can still be saved. Saved if we act now and act boldly." She had long, thick, pink extension braids like Deshauna wore when they were in school. Another woman handed out leaflets. Morgan took one and stepped up to Kevin. "Excuse me," she said, "could I please speak to you for a minute?" Kevin looked over at the speaker, talking about endangered species, particularly pollinators, critical for maintaining our food supply. Kevin handed his end of the extinct banner to the woman beside him. He stepped forward. "You happened to be walking by," he asked, "or were you coming to Amazon?" "No," she said, "I came to find you." "How'd you know I'd be here?" "Your voicemail." He nodded. "Okay," he said. "Well, it's not like my offer still stands. I know who your boyfriend is, or was. Did you break up? You're looking for a little activist action after the fact? Forget it." Morgan's mouth contracted into a tight circle. "No, that's not it," she said. "This isn't about you, or you and me. I came to find you because I..." She leaned toward him. "I found something out. Something your movement needs to know." His face changed from wary to concern. He looked around and saw a few cameras setting up. "Let's go somewhere we can talk," he said. He gave her the name and address of a nearby bar. "Meet me there in 10 minutes.
It's tough to read from a novel because there's all this context built up that you all won't have, so I'm just going to read a section and you may not know everything that's going on, and that's okay. The only thing you need to know is that main character Mazzy and her significant other Dewey have been caught up in a giant flood. They had climbed up into a fire watchtower on top of a mountain in California that was swept into this flood, and now they're adrift in the waters. "I have no accounting for how long it rained or if the rain that fell over Dewey and me had swallowed the globe. I only know that after a long darkness, a blush of light appeared in the west, a dim rosy glow that quickly ceded to the night. Clouds thinned and parted, the sky laid bare. My teeth chattered and I straddled the ridge of the roof and gazed up at the stars, crisp and twinkling. It was long since I'd last seen the stars. Never had I seen so many and so bright. The cosmos wheeled in capillaries of fire, luminous dust, haphazardly strewn, all that cold celestial light reflected upon the mottled surface of the sea. Boundless water and stars, maybe somewhere up there the children were eating cake. A great calamity would befall the world. That's what Joe Sam had told me. He'd wanted to clean the slate as God had in the time of Noah. Was this rain his bidding, or had God, craving relief from what we'd become, once again drowned our wickedness? I thought of Mally Sandoval, not the woman I knew or the actress, but the girl on a boat screaming up at a God who spoke only in wind. And like that girl, I wanted to hear the voice that once commanded Noah. I wanted to glimpse the face of God. When I tried to imagine God's face, I could only picture my mother, her kind eyes peering down from the utter dark. I could feel her hand caressing my cheek. Are you hungry? Are you warm? Do you know that I love you? Say the words, touch every cheek for 1,000 years of peace, but no face showed itself, no caressing hand. I peered up at the night's shimmering shroud and gleamed only the profound emptiness spanning the galaxies of ice. What if there was no God, the rebelling climate, this rain, the nexus of our greed and the denial of inconvenient truths, these wars from nations ruled by psychopaths prodding us like scorpions in a tub, their whims of killing, nothing that would ever lead to peace, death begetting death in the battle of the dreams. Please, I beg the stars, show yourself. Tell me how to heal the anger and pain, how to not be afraid. Please, God, just one word. Just one word. But the sky hung silent. Nothing stirred in the pitch fast station but the spectral pricks of stars long dead. And confounded in this clamp of ancient light, I cursed the sky. My screams quickly melting into a lifetime of tears held dam, a spate of tears for a flooded world. Tears to a flooded world. I wept beneath the still mute heavens.
So my book is told from three points of view: Rich the logger, Colleen his wife, and their little boy Chubb, who's five when the book opens. So this is from a chapter early in the book. It's in Colleen's point of view. And I think all you need to know is that she is quiet and responsible. She's suffered a series of miscarriages. And her younger sister, Enid, is wild and carefree and has six kids, and she hasn't brought their immunization records to the school. So, and the school knows better than to ask her for them. So they've called her sister, who's agreed to drive her down to the health clinic, which is about an hour south of where they live, to pick up those records. Except they were supposed to meet at the turnoff, and when Colleen got there, Enid wasn't there. So she's driving out this logging road to get to her sister's house, and this is what she finds when, and she's ticked, and this is what she finds when she gets there. The rifle wasn't the first thing she noticed when she bounced down Enid's muddy driveway. What she noticed was Tice Whelan's tow truck, gleaming black with its bright blue hook. She set the parking brake, Chubb's cue to undo his seatbelt, and before she could register the rifle Enid held loosely at her side, a crutch too short to lean on, Chubb was scampering across the yard, hopping the creek, and disappearing up the steps into the trailer house. Growing up past the last telephone pole, Enid had always sworn she'd move down south, beyond where the redwood curtain parted. Someplace you could buy a hot dog on the street at midnight, or one of those big doughy pretzels that looked like it should hang on a door like a Christmas wreath. But here she was, way out Lost Road. She had a telephone that worked half the time when she paid the bill and a tree hadn't fallen on the line, but otherwise it was about as far from San Francisco as you could get. Tice Whelan didn't appear to have noticed the rifle yet either. He crouched, fitting a tow trap around the front wheel of her sister's new Wagoneer, red with veneered side panels. "You're making us late," Colleen said, as though Enid could hear her through the windshield. The runaway roses were blooming, pulling down the fence meant to pen the climbing goats, who balanced in the branches of their tree, watching Tice Whelan work. Colleen's mother's old Mercury was a mound of black-gray brambles, unrecognizable except for a side mirror that hung limply like the fin of a lethargic fish. She knew she should get out of the truck before Enid did something stupid, but first she wanted an apology. They'd agreed to meet at the Beehive, but this morning Colleen had found the gravel lot empty except for the sweet scent of the black-gray bear claws Dot pulled from the bakery's oven. Colleen had even gone inside to check. "Sorry, hon, haven't seen her. You want some coffee while you wait?" Dot had asked, the circles of rouge making her look like an overheated doll in her sequin sweater, her hair a platinum beehive. She'd been a beauty queen young, Miss Sanderson Timber, Miss Del Norte County, Miss Redwood Country. "Sweet as sugar and slower than molasses," Colleen's mom used to say. Next, Colleen had driven up to the turnout where Mill Road met the highway, the way Enid would have to come. She left a hole in her crossword, clue stuck like a kernel in her teeth. Desires, four letters. Loves, wants, needs, she couldn't make anything fit. She picked it at the whole way, past Rich's pickup lined up in the mill lot with the others, out No Name Road, gravel popping against the truck's underbelly, past a nation grove and down the steep pump onto Lost Road. and now here was her sister, holding the repo man at gunpoint. Colleen sighed. Getting upset at Enid wouldn't change her. She closed her eyes, wishing she could open them and see the yard tidy. No Tice, no tow truck. Enid raised the rifle. 31 years old, and still here was Colleen trying to keep trouble from crashing down around her little sister. Colleen climbed out. "Hi, Tice," she said. "Don't talk to him," Enid snapped. The Whelan twins were identical, down to the rat tail Tice wore at the back of his shaggy hair. But Colleen could tell them apart from Lyle, who worked as a bucker on Rich's logging crew, by the topless mermaid tattooed on his neck. The only marks Rich had on his body were scars, decades worth of nicks and gashes, hard white lines of healed skin like the skeleton of a fish on the inside of his forearm, where he'd been cut to the bone as a teenager, sewn up, and sent right back out to work. "Take those things off," Enid ordered Tice, who was already securing the second trap. Enid's blue eyes flashed, her eyeliner making her short white blonde hair, long behind the ears, appear even whiter. "Enid, stay out of it, Colleen, I mailed the check." Tice Whelan went around to the other side of the wagoneer. "Whelan, I swear to God." Colleen felt the slide of the bolt in her chest. "Don't make me shoot you between your damn eyes," Enid threatened. "You gonna load that thing first?" Tice asked. Enid checked the empty chamber, choked up on the barrel, and started toward him. "I'll bash your skull in and eat your brain with a spoon." Tice backed up. He was used to having guns pointed at him, but the stock was oak. And though he was missing an eye tooth, he still had a good straight nose.
Thank you all so, so much. Thank you. I would love to now turn it over to all of you for Q&A. If you have some questions. Yes, I see some hands. I'll come up to you. I saw a hand here, and then we'll go to you.
Hi, thank you for speaking with us today. I'm Katie Delt from the University of Florida. Can you all share, I specifically, I saw that you once did, or still do, I'm not sure, spoken word. And I could hear that in some of your voices, the symbols and poetry. I want to know more about how you come up with your symbols as a poet, how you think, how poetry filters your perception of the world. Kind of like the last question.
What I'll say is, even when I did spoken word, I was always sort of more of a prose poet. So I've always been the storyteller. And the struggle for me, like with all these books, I was writing a book a year, so you gotta crank them out, right? And the first draft for me is just plot dialogue. So I have to fight for all the imagery, I have to fight for all the sensory details. Like my mind is always like, what's this story? So over the years, I've really had to work to be able to paint that full picture. And in my spoken word career, I did spoken word, I did a little hip hop theater. Like it was very much about the social commentary. And yet the work that I did in poetry where you really are writing word by word was important in my development as a writer. So I like to be able to zoom in, but the novel is sort of more of a zoomed out perspective on something. So for me, I think that's been really important. The other thing that I'll say is I'm very extroverted, and I just, as a younger author, did not have the attention span to sit by myself in a room and write. And so I needed that kind of collective ritual of like, I write something and then, you know, within the next 72 hours, I'm on a stage sharing it with people. And so as I've gotten older, I've had more of an attention span and can actually spend hours and hours sitting by myself to develop something. So that's been my journey.
I read poetry every day. It's a huge part of who I am as a consumer of art and consumer of the world. And I think it has to do, it comes to me being a writer, with the idea that I don't want you just to understand what a sentence means, but I want the sentence to feel a particular way too. and that's as important in creating an experience that's not just going to be an intellectual experience, but it's going to be an experience that engages you emotionally and imaginatively and sinks at a deeper level. That's what I look for when I read poetry first thing in the morning. When I get up, I read poetry, and it kind of sets a temperament for me to the day and puts me in a contemplative place. And that's what I work towards with my own writing, no matter if it's a story or a novel, either way.
Actually, can I invite people who have questions to come make a line right up here?
Hi, my name is Cameron. I'm a student in the Freelance Environmental Justice Reporter with the U.S. South.
Award winner,
thank you. My question, I'm not sure how applicable this is to your individual stories, but I would love your perspective on this. So I had recently heard that oftentimes dystopian novels and dystopian stories are the fears that they represent, whether about the climate crisis or some other form of injustice or oppression, is actually has been the historical realities of many minoritized populations. And so I think that that can also extend to climate dystopia, climate fiction even, this idea that the issues or the harms of the climate crisis that might be depicted as something far off in the future is actually what minoritized populations are experiencing now. So just curious, in your opinion, how we could go about, as writers, as fiction writers, people interested in fiction, making sure that we're centering inclusive histories and climate experiences.
So I think that's such a good question, and the geese agree. So for me, I work with the Movement for Black Lives, and the Black Hive is the climate justice and environmental justice organizing formation within M4BL. And you know, that's part of what we talk about, that, you know, historically a white-dominated environmental movement has talked about the climate crisis coming in the future. And I think that, you know, if we look globally for people of color, but especially for Black people and people of African heritage, like, it has been coming for us. And our lives are, you know, threatened and being lost now. And so for me, part of what I've been... One of the things I work with M4BL, I'm on the comms and narrative focus team, so like what are the stories that we're telling about this? One of the things that I've been thinking about is this sort of framing that we're calling Parable of the Movement. And here on this 30th anniversary of Octavia Butler's Parable of the Sower, we have this brilliant work of Black climate fiction that is 30 years old, where she, you know, the prophecy of this book is incredible. She talked about how there would be this racist white president with the slogan, Make America Great Again, and that there would be, you know, this kind of rise of racism, and that the climate crisis would be devastating communities, and there'd be this vast income inequality and all the things, right? And so, but Butler's history was that she wrote the first parable series. It was supposed to be a trilogy. The next book was supposed to be about solutions, but she didn't have them. She didn't know what the solutions were back then. So her second book was sort of about increased conflict and false solutions. And she wanted to write that third book about solutions, but she didn't have the hope. And the movement wasn't developed at that time. And so she kind of put down the trilogy, and then she passed away before she could finish it. And this parable of the movement as idea is that we, particularly Black people who are in this movement, we are the third book. And we are the solutions. And that, you know, it's really critical that writers and movement be connected. right? Because it's not just about imagining and documenting, it's also about being that force that can make things happen. So we're currently trying to figure out, Octavia Butler's birthday is June 22nd, so we're currently developing activities and written work, you know, maybe an op-ed for Juneteenth, because essentially Juneteenth is about Black people in Texas and certain parts of the South after the Emancipation Proclamation didn't get the news, you know, for a long period of time, and we're continuing to live in the dystopia that was the period of slavery, even though supposedly they were free and then getting the news. And the parallel for me is that we have the climate solutions, right? But a lot of us haven't gotten the news that the solutions are all there, you know? And we're sort of living in this time where people feel that hope is lost, but it actually hasn't been, and being part of sharing that news.
I work for a conservation organization that has a dual mission of public land protection and supporting the sovereignty of indigenous communities. It's called the Grand Canyon Trust. And so, and I think that, like, so a lot of the work that we do, we're invited in by communities that are facing, you know, a mining operation, a development, something that is at odds with their wishes for their ancestral lands. And I think that like a lot of the books that I want to read are in those communities. It's just waiting for someone to write them. I think that in particular about the Ute Mountain Ute community in White Mesa, Utah, which lives 3 miles down the road from the last operating conventional uranium mill in the US, where radioactive waste from all, like, from Superfund sites from as far away as Estonia and Japan is being shipped and disposed of. And I think that, like, I had that experience in kind of a microcosm in this book, because I couldn't have written this book without the help of many Yurok tribal members whose ancestral lands are along the Klamath River and who were never removed, who are still there, who have always been there, and whose identity is very closely tied to the Klamath River and to the salmon. And those dams wouldn't be coming off the Klamath if it weren't for the Yurok. And one of the people at Yurok who helped me is a woman named Amy Cordalis, who's the general counsel for the Yurok tribe. And I thanked her in the acknowledgments of this book. And an agent in New York saw that and called her and signed her. And so she's writing a book called Child of Big Water about her family's history along the Klamath. She comes from a family of traditional Yurok fishers. And I think, like, hers was a book that I was looking for when I was researching this one, and I couldn't find it. And I wish it would have been published 10 years ago, but I'm really happy that it's coming. So I think there are a lot of stories in those communities that are coming.
Hi, my name is David Hellhart. I like the parallel universe we saw Wednesday night, where there's a President Trump, only she's a tall elephant with many beliefs in science. So I've written 6 nonfiction books, including a memoir, and 3 unpublished novels set in San Diego, Nicaragua, and Antarctica, where I've done a lot of reporting. And Alan, you said that your hardest, toughest students are journalists. So I'd like to ask any of you about what's the challenge, you know, to expand on the challenges journalists face, and also what can we do to overcome our disability as journalists?
I think it's getting used to understanding the journalists use words to tell stories. They're using it in a different manner. And I said, whenever I get mentoring writers who have a theater background, they do better because they immediately understand how to inhabit a character who is not them, and to be able to fully move into that space. What I find when I work with people with a journalism background is there's a resistance to that, a hesitance, because it's counterintuitive to what the job of a journalist is, which is collecting, of being neutral, of being absent, being objective, even though we could have an argument that that doesn't exist, but that's the idea behind journalism, as opposed to fully moving into a point of view, of fully inhabiting it, and not just intellectually, but emotionally, imaginatively, and finding the words to express not just an understanding of something, but an experience of something lived. And so it's, I say they struggle with it, but that's not to say they can't do it. Very quickly, most journalists that I've worked with move very quickly in the understanding, as soon as you can flip that switch and understand, okay, you know what method acting is? You need to become the character. Stop thinking like you. You're not a journalist writing a book. You're inhabiting a character and moving through the world as them. And now use all of the abilities you have with words, your observational skills, and all of these other things that you've accrued through your profession, and utilize those just though in a different means.
I would just say I don't think there are very many published novelists who don't have three unpublished novels in their desk drawer, so that seems very normal to me. And I think that, like, at least in my experience, there's just a lot of failure in fiction writing. It's just part of it. And I think that, like, the best thing you can do for yourself is learn how to dwell, like, exist and be happy in that sort of territory of hope that borders delusion.
Oh, this is such good advice. The one thing that I'll add is when you transfer from one type of writing that you've gotten really proficient or good at or are working in professionally to another type of writing, you have to get used to not being good, you know? And it's hard, right? Because, you know, you get in your 10,000 hours or whatever and you know how to, like, knock it out. And I think that that's the biggest thing, like that humble place of being ready to fail and to keep going even when you've failed, or to getting feedback like, oh, this really needs a lot of work. And I think that's the hard part. Like, I get used to, like, okay, I can get what's in my mind out on the page with less work than it used to be, and then you take on something new and now it's gonna be more work again. And so it's sort of going back to that drawing board.
We have time for one more question. Okay.
Hi, my name is Catherine Madisic, and I'm with Tangled Play Studio. And I'm only asking this because nobody else is in line. Alan, this question is very similar to the one that was just asked. And that is this idea of how do journalists, you know, who are, again, committed to objectivity, but I would even say, you know, the big thing that comes to mind for me is we're trained not to put words in people's mouths, right? Not to think for them because you don't know them and you might be thinking the wrong thing. And so to me, that's the real barrier to achieving this empathy that you all are talking about. And so what I want to know is, if we train ourselves to do a good job of being observant and really immersing ourselves to the point to where we're close, right? How do you then translate that not into fiction but into everyday journalism? What are the actual techniques to do that without thinking for your characters, so to speak?
You have to get it right. So, I mean, that's a huge part about inhabiting a character who's not you. Is really doing a lot of work off the page and a lot of deep thinking and trying to figure out if I'm going to make this empathetic jump into someone who is not me, how am I putting words in the mouth of that person that will be true and real. And you cannot get it wrong. And that's kind of the short answer. You can't get it wrong. You have to get it right. And if there's any rule, like in the creative writing classroom, about inhabiting characters, okay, if you're going to go into this other character and inhabit them, you have to do all of the work. You have to do all the work whatever that means, in finding your way into full empathetic capacity, not just I'm going to tiptoe in because I'm playing puppets and putting on a puppet show for someone. It's not that. You have to do all of the work, the hard work, sometimes an enormous amount of work to get a background and understanding, a real true understanding, so that you get it right. You have to get it right.
I love that, and I agree. And the one thing that I'll add, and this is a place that I see people go wrong, is that they do all of the research to go in and then they feel like, okay, I did this research and I made this leap and I got it. And really, I think the key part of the work that's missing is then afterwards you have to check, right? And so people do the research, they go in and they bring all this stuff, but we have our lens, right? And that was my argument around the big controversy with American Dirt. You know, she did a ton of research, years of research, but you know, the racism in her lens meant that she didn't get it right. And then she didn't check because she didn't have a network of people that she was connected to that were in the constituency she was writing from. And she also kind of asked for help at the 11th hour and didn't offer to pay, right? So that's the other thing, you know, you gotta figure out how the resources work in journalism, but you have to either have the network or have the resources or have the editorial support for people who can not just check the other parts of the story, but can check whether your empathy leap actually worked.
I hesitate to answer this because I think I might give you really bad advice, mainly because like I could teach a very detailed class in the most inefficient way to write a novel. You know, like my novel is about 130,000 words long and I wrote 1,000,000 words. And so one way that eventually worked for me was just to write a lot. And you know, my book takes place over the course of a single year and you get about 90 to 100 days. I wrote all 365. I wrote some of those days from all the different points of view. And I think the disadvantage of doing that is it will take you 10 years and you'll have like several mental breakdowns along the way maybe. But I think the advantage of doing it that way is that you get to know your characters really well. You see how they behave when they're afraid, when they're happy, when they're longing for something, when they're grieving. You know what they got for Christmas when they were 6 years old. And sort of having all that backstory about them helps you sort of understand if confronted in this situation, what would they do? And I think also having the willingness, I think the journalists I know all write nonfiction, and I notice that they outline their books and they're very clear about where the book is going. And like when you write nonfiction, like there is one way that it ends, right? And you have to be loyal to reality and to the facts. And I think being open in fiction so that like when you put a person on the page, you are not completely in control of them. Like you may want them to go this way and they might wander over that way, and just to trust that and follow them, because they will, I mean, they can take you down a dark alley that dead ends, but they can also like take you through a door that opens up into a different world that you didn't realize was there. So I think just sort of being open to change and following your characters where they lead you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Can we just have one more round of applause?